All right, let me, so just to recap, what we did yesterday in the morning, we talked sort of about sort of the very basic mechanism of what leads to spikes in cells. And we talked about a voltage, a current, right, a channel that changes conductance state depending on what the voltage is. And then, you know, in response to David Gross's question about how this happened, we sort of waved our hands around and talked about dipoles interacting. We'll continue to wave our hands around this morning, except we'll just do it with maybe just a little more formalism. But the experimental data is sort of very equivocal in showing that there's channels whose conductance property change with voltage. And we also learned about channels whose conductance properties change when a ligand binds to them, right? This is responsible for neurotransmission. So either there's some deformation energy when you bind a small molecule, or there's some electrostatic energy when you change the potential across the membrane. And these could snap channels between open states and closed states. Okay, and this was sort of the fundamental basis of the action potential. And we talked about the action potential sort of being used in neurons sort of as a computing device to sort of take you from some low level of voltage in the cell where you're summing your inputs, okay, to some higher level where you could actually activate the output of the cell. All right, so it's sort of mediating the logic of the cell, right? And then we went on yesterday and talked about various other things with diffusion and the whole point was that, you know, cells really, biology seems to do its best to try to compartmentalize the world. I mean, there are synaptic spines that try to keep the chemistry local. That this, for better or worse, is this little bit of a reoccurring theme. Okay, so one of the, what's going to happen today is I'm going to review basically, this is just classic textbook material. I'm going to review sort of the story of the ionic basis of the action potential. This is the work of Kenneth Cole and Katz and Hodgkin and Huxley. And it's a pretty story, and you know, there's very little dogma in biology at some level, right? You think you understand something, and then somebody puts their hand up in the back of the audience, oh, I've been studying this system, and everything you say is wrong. But it seems to be, as I mentioned yesterday, it's sort of a constant that you have spikes. If the spikes go from low voltages to high voltages, it didn't have to be this way. It's an experimental observation. And that these spikes are primarily mediated by sodium currents. We just want to sort of shake out sort of the sort of basic experiments and the paradigm of these experiments, which is to individually measure voltage-dependent conductances and then take the sum of these measurements and put them back together and try to predict what the detailed voltage dependence is a sort of reoccurring theme. When you open up J Neurophysiology today and you read it and somebody talks about thalamic, you know, sub-threshold oscillations in thalamic neurons and all 14 channels that they measured, and basically it's the same prescription, right? It's the self-consistency argument of having measured the voltage dependence of individual currents and then put those currents together with Kirchhoff's law. Okay. So this is work that I'm going to describe that started in the 30s and took sort of reached its peak in the late 50s, maybe early 60s, depending how you count. And I think these guys made a lot of progress because people knew electrical engineering well already at that point, since the late 1880s or more, and they knew electrochemistry. So there's this theoretical framework out there for sort of how to hang your data, right? So it made it very nice. Okay, so this is a squid. So these are interesting little suckers because they sit there in the water and they just the back of the animal here is this mantle that fills with water and then it just fills with water and then there's a wave of contraction. It's all muscle in the back, which everybody knows because you go to a restaurant and you order calamari and you know everybody's happy and whoosh, right, and they just squirt, right? So these guys have a very strong muscle, and somehow they must have a way of propagating electrical activity down this muscle very rapidly. And it was sort of shown very nicely in this data from J.Z. Young. And what we see on the right-hand side is a cross-section of a nerve from the rabbit. Okay, look at the size of those individual axons. And we see on the right hand side is this axon in the squid. I mean, this sucker is enormous. You can take an entire fruit fly, right, with its entire nervous system, huge visual motor tracking system, and basically stuff it inside that nerve. Okay, didn't quite make it as far as miniaturization goes. Okay, now we'll see a little later that part of the problem is that in cables, and I didn't dwell on this yesterday, but you know, the bigger the cable, the bigger the axon, the faster the speed. It's a very weak dependence. It goes like the square root of the radius. Sort of mammalian systems have discovered this trick of sort of dropping the capacitance by wrapping the axon in more and more myelin called Schwann cells. But the squid hasn't done this. But this guy is so big, it's really allowed a number of things. First of all, before the days of micromanipulators, it really allowed people to go in and do experiments where you literally stuff the wire, okay, inside an axon. Okay, and then there's this beautiful experiment that goes back to Kenneth Cole. All right, so Kenneth knew about these axons. This is an interesting experiment because there's a little morality lesson here. And I realize it's a little early in the morning for morality lessons. But Kenneth took this axon, right, and put it in a... So you can do this in the privacy of your own garage, right? You get a lobster, you tease out a single nerve fiber, you take a plate, and you have this thing just sitting in this little trough, and you take some really, like, goopy sugar solution or Vaseline and make... sort of block the ends so you don't have electrical conduction in your little trough from one end to the other. And then you go in and you can stimulate at one end, you put a pair of wires there and just very briefly plug it into the electrical outlet, okay? And then have your portable oscilloscope, which you probably have, okay? And measure the electrical activity elsewhere on the axon. And what these guys saw was interesting. What they saw was what's shown here on this trace. This is probably the most famous trace in all of biophysics. They actually saw a change. They gave a little shock, and they saw a change in the voltage. They saw an impulse, right? So the first measurement of impulse, okay, done by using a squid axon instead of blocking the stimulation site away from the recording site, right? And this guy is big, and the currents are large, and all these, you know, fancy 10 to the 14 ohm FETs, which didn't exist in these days, aren't needed. Okay. The other thing these guys did was they, so the Cole brothers, right, known for the Cole plot, are measured the impedance of everything they could get their hands on. I mean, it was definitely the case of somebody, you know, to them, it's like to a hammer, everything is a nail. Okay, and. So they found that during the action potential, the impedance, okay, of the membrane dropped severely. Okay, so they had a bridge, a Wheatstone bridge. Everybody knows what a bridge is. You're passing equal amounts of current in four arms of a bridge, and of course the voltage drop across the of any opposite points in the bridge is zero when it's balanced, and then one of the legs of the bridge was the squid axon, and it completely went out of balance, and what you're seeing here is this out of balance signal. Okay, so they knew about this a good 6 or 7 years before Hodgkin and Huxley, right? And they didn't exploit it. They also had invented the voltage clamp, and they didn't exploit it. So the lesson is that everything to them was a nail. So if you're, it's good to have a, it's not good to get too focused on one technique. Okay, they made the initial discovery. Okay, so let's see what's happening. Okay, let me just go on a little bit. There's a couple of other sort of historical pieces of information. So this again is a squid axon. Okay, this comes from an experiment from Hodgkin and Katz. Okay, now yesterday we talked. There's a reason to my madness here. We talked yesterday about the cable equation, okay, that we wrote down what the voltage would look like along a cable, and had a couple of pieces. It had sort of a displacement current, sort of a CdV dt piece. It had a V over R piece. It had a diffusive piece, the fact that it's a long cable, and this was equal to the sum of the injected currents, right? This is just Kirchhoff's law for all the elements in a little cable. Now, there's two issues that come up. One issue is just trying to understand exactly how the action potential is formed, right? And the other issue is trying to understand, you know, why it propagates. Okay, so I'll show you the propagation data in a moment. But I think part of the brilliance of Katz and Hodgkin and Huxley was that they went ahead and they just wiped out space. Okay, and I showed you before that this axon, let's look at the size of this thing. Okay, that scale is 100 microns. This guy is 400 microns in diameter. Okay, you could just call up the California Wire Company and you can buy yourself a wire for extracellular recording, which is 25 microns in diameter, just off the shelf, right? If you give them a little extra time and money, they'll give you 12 microns. Okay, so this guy is so enormous, you can just shove a wire down the entire axon. And that's what they did. And they just, you know, from a conceptual point of view, they simplified the situation tremendously because they destroyed space. They just made the inside of the squid axon perfectly conducting, okay? And because of that, it allowed them just to focus, okay, sort of on the temporal dynamics, and allowed them just to focus on what will be the voltage dependencies of these various currents, okay? So sort of a very basic experiment is shown here, and we'll get into more detailed ones, but what we... just to show that, in fact, the role of sodium is so important. So if you look in and say, just pick a trace, let's pick trace A. Okay, this is normal seawater, and they fire an action, they stimulate. Okay, it's shown here. It's this cute little cartoon. They made it look like one of those little kids' balloons that are very long. Okay, and you get a bump, which is trace A, and then they drop the concentration of sodium, okay, in the bath. And you can see that the action potential, a couple of things happen, okay? It's the rise time, it takes longer to get going, the delay is greater, and also the amplitude is down. And then they do the control experiment of restoring, okay, the sodium concentration in the bath, and the action potential comes back. So it's a very clean experiment, okay? And it really shows very strongly that sodium is a major part of the action, okay? Okay, so the last kind of historical experiment really has to do with, and I said they wiped out space, but we're at the very, very end of the day, we're going to want to get back to this. Okay, we're going to actually want to understand something about the propagation speed. And so let me just, again, so this is the same setup that we had before, but if you notice in the previous picture, so you have this tube. Okay, this was actually the days before you could get these very fine wires, but if you take the glass you use to make pH electrodes, it's extremely porous to ions. Obviously, it's pH glass, right? Hydrogen ions. So they actually just put a glass wire down it. Okay, this is just one of these little fun details. But what's happening here is that now space is kept. Again, they stimulate over on the right, and then they look at various points along these axons. And you can see a pulse, okay? And you can see the pulse it actually propagates, right? This is choroid axon, which is acting like a cable. It's out of electrical equilibrium. Okay, so at early times the pulse is here at A, and somewhat later time it's at B. Okay, now the key thing to notice out of this is that if it was just a simple passive cable, okay, then the pulse is actually diffusing. Right. I skipped over this a little bit yesterday, but when we looked at the cable equation, when we looked at this much is a diffusion equation. Okay. And yesterday we saw that the diffusion equation has this kind of solution, you know, that it just spreads. Okay. If we go to the cable equation, in fact, it looks exactly like a diffusion equation with just an additive term. Right, so you could convince yourself you could transform from a cable equation to a diffusion equation just by writing, just by substituting in e to the minus, you know, t over tau. You know, v equals u e to the minus t over tau. Very standard. Okay, so if we're just passive, we would have expected something which was just like diffusion, except we're not conserving charge, because charge is leaking out of the membrane resistance. Okay, and we would have expected something to broaden, but it doesn't broaden. Okay, so so all these things have to be understood. Okay, so this is kind of the historical background of what's going on. So let me now just kind of sketch. Okay. The amazing high-tech board. Okay, so these were kind of the ideas that are involved. Is that okay? So one is the idea of lipid sort of makes two compartments. Okay, inside and outside, and this is sort of a means to develop and sort of ionic gradients. Okay. The thing we didn't talk about so much in detail yesterday, I'm just going to skip, it's a fairly textbook item, is the idea that pumps, whose time scale are slow compared to channels, active channels, maintain the gradient, okay, so something has to form these ions or something has to maintain it. Okay, this is why you have to eat every day. Okay, you need the pumps. I mean, just to give you a feeling for the energy involved in the pumps, if you don't wear your bicycle helmet and you fall off your bicycle and you go into concussion, they take you to the emergency room, the first thing they do is they turn off your brain by giving you high levels of barbiturates, okay, to try to cut down the swelling a little bit. But still, the energy balance of your brain is about half as it is when you're thinking. Okay, and it's basically about half the energy is being dissipated in maintaining these pumps. So it's a pretty substantial load. I mean, you get these impression from all these fMRI images that, you think of, somebody at the beach, boy, girl, depending on your preference, right? You're going to explode with increase in metabolic activity. But we're talking small potatoes, right, compared to the balance of what's going on. Okay. The other thing that holds is that electrochemistry holds. This means the basic, we'll sketch this in a second, basic idea of Boltzmann factors of something people knew going into this. So it had some functional form of how the channels could react to voltage. Kirchhoff's laws hold. Okay, this seems, again, just to go back to basics, I mean, we're able to write down a circuit equation. You might say this is why people have trouble making progress now on sort of networks, because we have, we don't really have sort of this hard dogma in place like people had for individual cells. Okay, and the last point is we see is that we have channels whose conductance changes with voltage. Okay, so in words, these are all the essential ingredients. Okay, so yesterday we went through this kind of log dog and pony show to derive what would be the IV characteristic for a membrane, right? And the basic idea yesterday was that you've established this ionic gradient across the membrane, and it's very easy to go from high concentration to low, more difficult to go from low concentration to high. It makes sense. We all know this is how diodes work. Okay, and we derived an algebraically ugly but sort of reasonably precise equation that describes sort of the IV characteristic. Okay, just to make a little, what this looked like, just to remind everybody, is something like the following. There's a terrible sign convention. So we had one limiting slope here and one limiting slope there. So this would be high to low and low to high. Okay, now if you operate a little bit, and we could kind of see this, because what the current looks like is a lot of constants. One of these constants was the diffusion through the membrane of the pore, right? The diffusion through the membrane of the pore, all right? So this is where the voltage dependence is going to come in. This is where I'm sort of allowed to shove in extra voltage dependence, because this depends somehow on the size of the pore, okay? And we estimated yesterday even what sort of the current through a reasonable-sized pore is. Okay, now, what's usually done is to say, well, you know, we're typically not working right at this... very close to this reversal potential, right? The reversal potential is where the Nernst potential, okay, is just equal to EV over KT. So just from this formula, you can see that these two exponents would cancel out, right, when the voltage is just equal to the Nernst potential. Just sort of rewrote the algebra here. Okay, so there's a dirty trick. You'd like to say, oh, okay, I'm just going to, this is pretty linear, okay? And saying it's pretty linear is just taking all of this stuff, which has the form of a conductance, and multiplying it times voltage. Okay, it's not quite true, because if you actually want to go through the zero, you're ending up with a sort of unjustified extrapolation, right? Okay, but unfortunately, this has sort of crept into the literature. So I'm just going to, what we're going to do is that we're going to take all the ugly voltage dependence, and we're going to write the current in this form of a conductance as a function of voltage and time, times the voltage of the cell minus the reversal. Let's say we do this for sodium. Sort of in this form. We're shoving all, sort of all the ugly voltage dependences in this form. Okay, so I'm just doing this to make a little bit of progress. And it was actually a couple of years after the original Hodgkin-Huxley papers came out that sort of this more precise formalism was finally applied. The details really didn't change. Okay. Okay, that's the first thing. So now let's just make a little progress and see what the form of this should be. Okay. What is this guy going to look like? Okay. Well, we have a little bit of notion. Okay. There's let's say there's a pore, and the pore has a certain size. So when the pore is open, okay, there's sort of some average, you know, open conductance, right? Just a constant, something to do with the size of the hole, okay? And then I have to put in a voltage probability, okay? So what I'm going to write this is that if I'm thinking dipoles now, right? I'm thinking a membrane with this pore. I'm thinking some voltage drop across this membrane, okay? And I'm thinking there are sort of dipoles that are going to interact, okay, with this voltage, right? There's going to be some interaction which looks like the dipole moment dotted into the electric field, or it's going to look like some dipole moment times the voltage over the thickness of the membrane. I'm thinking something like this, okay? And so therefore, there's a probability that if this, again, sort of as we discussed yesterday, that this dipole could change the size of the pore, right? So very generally, I could write this as some overall constant times the probability of activating this channel, okay? So there could be a dipole, which if it moves this way, tends to open the channel, okay? And at the same time, okay, there could be, now there might be many of these. There might be two dipoles that could turn this on, right? Think of many, many charges in the membrane, okay? And then on top of this, there could be, in fact, something that wants to close the thing. So there could be a dipole that's simply pointed in the other direction. Okay? So if the field gets too big, it actually tries to turn off this channel. Okay? So in this notation, I can just write this as sort of 1 minus an inactivating dipole. So somebody who's in the wrong notation, etc. Okay? Now, what's going to happen in practice is that if we look at one of these terms in reality, it'll turn out that there are both inactivating guys and there are activating guys. Okay, but they'll have the same functional form, right? So it didn't have to be, but it's true that there'll be multiple dipoles, but the ones that tend to open the channel will have the same voltage dependence, all have the same voltage dependence as the ones that will tend to close the channel. So this is kind of going to look something of the form of an average conductance times an activating guy as a function of V times some inactivating guy. Different guy, put a prime on him, as a function of V. So I've reduced the problem now to understanding how what the voltage dependence of one of these activating variables can look like. Okay, so to do that, we're sort of back to this very, very, very basic physics problem of understanding sort of a two-level system. It could be open, it could be closed. So let's see how a switch could work in a two-level system. And that'll give us the functional form. That functional form then will be a guide to understand the experimental data, right, and see how things fall together. All right, so I'm just going to I'm gonna erase this for a moment.
Mm-hmm. Just to make sure I understand properly. So now you assume that the conductance, if the channels were always open, say, the conductance will be the same above and below the reversal potential.
The conductance.
The downhill thing is wiped out now because we just take this linear function V minus V. V minus V.
Yes, I did that just for the moment. Right. Okay.
The nonlinearity is all in the channel opening.
Right. Right, so I'm doing this a little bit for the because of the way all the textbooks are written, and maybe this actually, to be blunt, this probably reflects a certain laziness on my part, because I would have had to sort of refit all the old data. But I since in fact we're going to be the data that's actually going to be fit is all sort of in this region, right? So I'm just stating that I'm getting away. If I was actually going to talk about something like calcium channel data, we will actually see the knee very strongly. You'd have a right to you know, ask for your money back and complain. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
About sign convention, it's really confusing. Can you say, because it looks like this reverse. It looks like they're taking positive current to the motion of positive ions. Like kind of different.
Oh, the sign convention. Oh my God.
Because if it goes from high to low, it means it goes from outside to inside, and the positive sodium ion moving and current is positive. Is it always reversal?
Okay, wait. Okay, so the sign I hate sign conventions. Okay, the sign convention is that the outside of the cell is pegged at zero. Okay. Okay. So low to high then puts puts the inside of the cell negative. Okay, because the positive ions will flow in, right? That satisfies the what do you call it, Benjamin Franklin rule, right? that's the positive charge carriers. Okay. Okay. So we can just gotta be quick. What I really need to do now is just write a little equation for what the probability of activation, this is supposed to be activation, looks like. Okay, so look, this is just very simple, right? This activation parameter can grow, okay, as follows. Okay, I know it could suck stuff off from the inactivated state, okay, with a rate that's given by 1 over the inactivation time constant, right? Nothing new. And it can go down by losing things from its own state. Okay, very, very, very simple. Okay, what else do I know? I know that the probability of being in the inactivated state plus the probability of being in the activated state is just conserved. Okay, so etc. I'll leave out a few algebraic steps. Okay, and what I'm going to do is define, actually, I apologize, this is obviously a function of time, too. Okay, and I just define the probability of activation at V and infinity as just the limit as time goes to infinity, so the steady state value of the activation parameter as a function of time, right? So what do? I take the inactivated guy and I replace the inactivated guy by 1 minus the activated guy. Okay? And what I'm left then is something here after a couple of steps that looks like the following. 1 over the activated time constant plus 1 over the inactivated time constant times the probability of being activated minus the steady state value. Okay, so let's just look at this. This is kind of obvious. In steady state, the time rate of change of the activation goes to 0. So the activation is just equal to its steady state value. Okay. The other thing is you have a rate process, right? So I have a chance of, I'm looking at a system that's equilibrating between two states. Okay. The time it takes to equilibrate, okay, it's just 1 over the sum of the rates. Okay? So when I look at an equilibration process, I get 1 time constant. Okay? So basically in the laboratory, I just observe, okay, 1 rate. Okay, this rate may be voltage dependent, but I just observe 1 rate. Okay, so this is just equal to a single inverse rate or time constant. Again, times the probability of being in the activated state minus its steady state value. Okay, so what I've done now is I've just sort of identified the two ingredients that I need to come to grips with. This is what I'm going to put into this equation. Okay, into this Hodgkin-Huxley equation. Okay, so here's our G. Just to remind everybody where we're going. I'm going to write this as a constant times the activation parameter of voltage and time, right? And now I've taken this activation parameter of voltage and time, and I split it into two pieces, a steady state value and a voltage-dependent time constant. So I just need to see what the functional form of these two look like, and then the problem is formally complete. Okay, so let's look at this guy. Okay, I hate writing on this board because it waddles, all right? So I'm going to erase this. Okay, so what we said then is we're thinking of a picture where there's a voltage drop and there's some dipole in this picture, okay? And this dipole has some interaction energy, which is the dipole moment dotted into the electric field. Okay, so what does that mean? That means, well, this guy has a charge, ZE. This dipole has a length, projected length, for better or worse, we'll just call it D. Okay, the electric field is just the voltage across the membrane divided by the thickness of the membrane, divided by the hydrophobic core of the membrane. Okay, so we're just going to lump all these parameters together. Okay, so what's this? This is some funky measure of sort of, you know, it looks like there's almost a fractional charge. You know, so you'd like to, because you're not exactly, the dipole spans only a fraction of the membrane. The dipole may be at an angle, so D is less than the full size of the dipole. But the important point is that this is just of the form, some constant, that's for a single dipole is less than 1 times the electronic charge times the potential. Okay, and from this immediately we know the following. Okay, we know that the ratio then of being in the activated state in steady state over being in the inactivated state in steady state is just equal to this Boltzmann factor. Okay? And the only thing I have to put in, so in by hand now, is the following, okay, is that there may in fact be some charges in the protein itself that have a bias field, okay? So in fact, this, right now the way I drew this, this thing is symmetric around zero voltage, okay? But if there are some charges in the protein, I get to add a little bias field. So I'm sort of adding by hand the fact that this could be is some, it's really some V minus some bias field over K Boltzmann T. Okay, so that's the functional form. Again, I also know that the activation parameter, as we said, plus the inactivation parameter, okay, is conserved. Okay, so from this, at the end of the day, I could just write down a form, okay, for what the activation looks like. And this is going to be sort of the standard Boltzmann curve going from saturation level of 0 to saturation level of 1. Okay, so this guy looks like all these ugly Boltzmann factors. Okay, over 1 plus this. Okay. That's great. And in pictures, this is just a smooth version of what we drew yesterday for the sort of brutalized turning on of a channel. So if this is the voltage axis, V, and this is the probability of activation axis, and this is nothing, okay, and this is 1, and this is 0, we can see what's happening. It's starting like this. I'm sorry. Okay, at very, very negative voltages, this thing is e to minus a negative number, so it's 0. At very high voltages, this is e to a plus big number over 1 plus e to a plus big number, so it's 1. And then it makes this transition, and it's halfway on at V bias. Okay? And the width of this transition, right, is basically given by this factor, okay, ZE over KT, right? So if it was a single, if it was actually a dipole that spanned the membrane, the width of this thing would be on the order of 25 millivolts, okay? Now, the thing I'm just going to, again, mention in passing is that the way many of these channels work is that they have a cooperative effect, is that there's not just one dipole, but as we'll see, there's going to be something like 3 dipoles or 4 dipoles. People sort of argue about the details. And the effect of this is only to increase the prefactor in the exponent, right? So you'll actually get channels that in reality are much sharper, right? And you actually get channels that in reality have a sort of larger prefactor due to what seems to be a combination of dipoles in the membrane. And this guy I'm just going to write here to get a scale. It's going to be, you know, somewhere between about 5 and 25 millivolts. Okay, this sort of governs the steepness with which the channel is turned on. So if this guy was 5 millivolts wide, basically you have an action potential. If you reach the idea of threshold is a little fuzzy now. Right? If you clearly jump the potential by 5 millivolts, you're going from completely on to completely off. But it's actually sort of a smooth transition. Okay. So this is piece number 1. Okay. So we'll let this guy stay here. And then let's do piece number 2. I think the way I defined it, this is plus. Yeah, plus, I think the way I defined it. Oh, I'm sorry. This should be plus. Okay, I was not consistent. Okay, right. So as the voltage goes up, you have a higher probability of being in the activated state by my convention. Sorry, I apologize. Okay. I will give out notes. I'm bad with signs. Okay. Larry will impress you by getting every sign right. I can't hope to keep up. Okay. Okay, I'm so bad with signs, I'm going to erase this part and then talk about the voltage dependence of the rate. Okay, so. Okay, score one. We got one more to do, right? This guy is a curve that looks like the following. Okay, let's see what this guy looks like. Okay, so to get some idea of what the time constant looks like, we need to think back a little bit about making a simple model with two wells and looking between the two wells. So let's just do it in pictures, and then we could add sort of a little math. So what we're thinking of is the following picture, that when V equals VB, the probability that we're activated and the probability that we're inactivated. Right, this is this thing all the chemists draw. These chemists always draw these energy versus reaction coordinate plot. Okay, I never understood what these things are, but I love to draw them because they're really great. Okay, and so when the voltage is just equal to the bias voltage, we have sort of equal probability of being in these two states. Now let's see what happens when we tilt the voltage a little bit. Okay. So in this plot, there's some time constant to go from the activated to the inactivated state. This is just the inactivation time. And there's also a time constant to go the other way, which is just the activation time. Okay. But you can see immediately that this is going to be very, very voltage dependent. And the reason is, so let's now go to a voltage that's very large compared to the bias voltage. In fact, it's so large, I'm going to extend the axis. Okay, so I have a plot that looks like the following. Okay, so this is really downhill. Okay, matter of fact, if I make this voltage large enough, I could even sort of lose this minima, right? So it's barely here. Okay, so in this case, the time, okay, to go into the activated state is severely reduced. Okay, now the time to go back uphill, of course, is lengthened. Okay, so this guy is now faster, or the time is shorter, and this one is now longer. Okay, but just remember, we said that 1 over the observed time is just 1 over the time to activate. Okay, plus 1 over the time to inactivate. Okay, so the time to inactivate is going to infinity. Big deal. This guy goes to 0, right? And this guy is rapidly going to 0. So that means the observed time is rapidly going to 0. Okay, so if we made a plot then, okay, of the observed time, okay, as a function of voltage, and this is VB, okay, then in fact, we expect to see something, okay, that looks like a ITP baseball cap, okay? And, okay, so we expect to see a mount, okay, just based on this kind of formalism. Okay, so without, okay, let's just leave it at that. You could actually push this through, and with small pain, you can just convince yourself, just the usual Boltzmann factor stuff, that this has to look at the following form. Okay, and this is simply by recognizing that 1 over the activation time of V is just equal to a prefactor okay, this prefactor contains all the ugly details about this energy hump, okay, and this is just gonna look like e to the minus it's the old story z prime over kbt. Okay, I don't want to get lost in the algebra. Okay, so let's see what we have. We have that this guy looks like a hump versus V. This guy looks like a sigmoid, a saturating curve versus V. The only essential physics that we put in is the idea of Boltzmann factors, right? Is the idea that as the voltage goes up or preferentially in one state, then the other. Okay, everything else is kind of a detail. So let's see how this compares with experiment, okay? Okay, so this is showing up on top. Okay, so there's two things I want to show. In Hodgkin-Huxley ease, okay, each of these activation and inactivation parameters was given a name. So if you go to a biophysics meeting and you see people sitting quietly on the bench and they're going, well, I get an exponent of 3 for m, and I get an exponent of 3.5 for m, and you're going, what is m, right? Maybe it sounds like out of a John le Carré novel or something. But these are the various activation parameters. So the activation parameter for sodium was given m for sodium, okay? And the inactivation parameter for sodium was given h for, I don't know, okay? And, well, let's just look at their functional form, okay? So the bottom trace are the activation, m is the activation parameter for sodium, n is the activation parameter for the voltage-dependent potassium current, which I just alluded to yesterday. And you can see they're both in the form of a sigmoid. They have slightly different slopes. The slightly different slopes, again, just reflect some you know, details of the protein and the screening of the dipoles, okay? And then you see H, which seems to go backwards, but that's just this inactivation parameter. So instead of, it's like a dipole that's facing the wrong direction. So this is actually a dipole that's trying to turn off the sodium channel. It sounds funny, it's going in the wrong direction, but if it's going in the wrong direction and it's slower, first it turns on, then it turns off. And this is this business of an activation that we talked about yesterday. So they're all roughly following sigmoids. So this looks good. This was sort of a good physical model. And then we look at the time constant, okay, as a function of voltage. And lo and behold, they are all igloos, okay, and little tats, okay. And in fact, in particular, I think the critical thing you see is that, just pick one. Let's pick H because he's the biggest one, okay. So just about the 50% point, okay, for the inactivation parameter is also where the time constant for the inactivation parameter is the longest. Okay, pull these channels away from equilibrium, right? The rate at which they work goes up. Okay, okay. So that's all said. Okay, now let's see how we put this whole thing together. All right, so now we have sort of we expect the data to fit a certain functional form, and I sort of jumped ahead and showed you that, in fact, the data does fit that functional form. But what do you do in an experiment? Okay, so we have something like this, okay? So I'm just going to now just rewrite this, that for sodium, in fact, this has an activation parameter, which people write as N of VT. Okay, and it has all these voltage-dependent time constants and voltage-dependent activation parameters. And it has an inactivation guy, which is given by H. And then I mentioned experimentally, it looks like this actually goes as a power. Okay, now, how would we actually measure this? You have this cell, okay, or this axon, and it has all these currents in it, right? Yeah.
You said the figures which you showed on experimental results for these various
yeah.
but are these parameters not derived from experiments by using already these formulae?
So, what was done in the Hodgkin-Huxley, what was done was to take these as functional forms, and then it's a fair point. So this is kind of free parameter, right? We don't really know what it is because it depends on detail. So one took this functional form that things look, you know, the activation curves that looked like e to the something v over kt over 1 plus something v over kt, and then you just fit these curves by fitting parameters. Okay, I was just going to go through how the experiment is done in a moment. So, I mean, one could have said, okay, I measure the currents, which I haven't shown how you do this yet, but I measure all these individual currents for sodium, I've measured the currents for potassium, and then I just, you know, it's a modern day, I fit cubic splines to the data and make a very smooth fit to the data. And then I just shove those voltage and time dependences back into this equation and then grind away. But these sort of functional forms were just used as guides, right, to fit the data. So at some level, it's curve fitting, but you're curve fitting that with highly constrained functional forms. And what I just wanted to show you that just thinking a little bit about stat-mec gives you the right functional forms, right, to fit the data. So I thought that was kind of an achievement. Yeah.
You said that the experimental curves agree with what we expect from the sequence, but that is obvious. And if we use already this formula, then it's clear that what we get out that the sequence.
No, it's not obvious. I think it could have, I don't know, it could have been the things that didn't hold. It could have been that you, for reasons that I don't know, you could have measured rate constants that I'll describe in a second how you measure these rates, but you could have measured rates as a function of voltage where were flat or had an opposite dependence. Okay, maybe I'll show some data. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is, bear with me, see if I have the right. Here. Okay. Let me just put this up. Okay, the dots are data points. Okay. The curve is one of these sigmoid Boltzmann's fits. Okay. Now, suppose it happened that the dots. Okay, well, this is the probability of inactivation, okay, as a function of voltage, okay? And the dots are data from different axons, even though if you read the Hodgkin-Huxley paper, 99% of the data is from axon 17, but it's okay. It was a great prep. And the smooth curve is the fit, okay? Now, you know, think about it. Maybe it wasn't going to be the data wasn't monotonic. Okay, maybe the data for some reason went down at low potential. I mean, you think of many, many things could have happened that the data didn't have to have this functional form. Okay, and that's all I'm saying. Maybe there's a functional form that fits the data better, but I mean, you know, this is sort of before the days when people went nuts and started doing F-tests and all this other sort of jazz, but it just seems to fit the data very well. That's all. Yeah.
What effect are you making on the data?
Okay, I'm going to get to this. So. Okay, let me bear with me one sec. This is totally disorganized now. Okay, we're organized. Okay, let me just explain what's going on. Okay, so this axon passes many ions, right? If I was to, I really want to measure currents, right? I want to measure the voltage dependence of currents, and so let's see what happens if I just take my cell, okay, and I inject some voltage, I inject some currents into the cell. The voltage is just going, the voltage is just going nuts, right? The voltage can do whatever it wants to do. It's not the experiment I want. I want to do an experiment, okay, in which I control the voltage. And I want to measure the current. Okay. I want to do the opposite sort of experiment. So I need to make a feedback system or a servo mechanism, right? Where I say I am gonna measure this voltage, and then I'm gonna pass any current, okay, that will hold that voltage. Okay, and in general, you can make very fancy servo systems. I could hold a voltage and let it wiggle as a function of time. Okay, Larry and Eve Marta made kind of a fancy clamp that you put in sort of a nice time-dependent voltage step, and you just went ahead and let your clamp run. But I need some servo mechanism that can do that. So that'll isolate the current as a function of voltage, which is what we want, right? Now, the second thing is that I need a way to pick out the currents due to individual ions, okay? Because right now I'm getting, well, let's see what we're getting, okay? Okay, so we have current flow due to sodium, we have current flow due to potassium, and then we have current flow due to everything else, which means chloride, the mystery A minus, okay? And this is all lumped together in, you know, in textbooks as far as a leakage current, right? Which is like that which we don't want, okay? But basically, for every ion, I have a set of equations for every ion. So I need to isolate single ions, okay? So today what we do is you get bit by a spider and you get this big welt because all sorts of channels are blocked and water passage isn't working anymore in your skin and there are toxins, there's chemistry that specifically block certain channels. This is sort of an experimental discovery, right? So there are things like pufferfish, which have blockers in them called tetrodotoxin, which block the sodium channel, right? Which you shouldn't eat pufferfish. And there's other molecules that literally stuff the pore. Like there's a molecule called tetraethylammonium, which just rams itself into the potassium channel and keeps the potassium channel from blocking. These things were sort of discovered over time through a mixture of sort of pharmacology okay. And so what you could do is that you could add various drugs and sort of iteratively convince yourself that you block certain channels. The other thing you can do is say, I'm only interested in potassium channels. I'm going to take this squid axon, okay, with its 800 micron bore, all right, and just completely flush it, okay, with my own solution. And my own solution is going to have no potassium, okay, and it's only going to have sodium in it. And therefore, I'm only sensitive to what's happening with sodium, okay? And therefore, I can measure the current flow only due to sodium. And I can just be careful about putting sugars in to keep the total solutes, the total osmotic strength constant, okay? So in order to do this first trick, okay, we need something called a voltage clamp. Okay, so I'm just going to sketch this very quickly because a week from Wednesday is kind of high techno-weenie day when I'll sort of talk about various measurement technologies. But the basic idea is the following. You build a device. It's called an operational amp. They're about 29 cents at Radio Shack, although if you buy one for electrophysiology from Axon Instruments, they're now up to about $10,000. I never quite understood the difference. Okay, and the interesting thing about this device is that it has an output voltage, which just looks at the difference between two input voltages and multiplies it by a big number. Okay, so it's funky. So the only way actually to use this device is in a feedback mode. Okay, so if I was to connect the minus terminal to the output terminal, okay, then what would happen is it would try to keep all three of these levels at the same voltage. So we'd just sort of be following the voltage along. Okay, now what I do in a servo mechanism is I take two electrodes. I'm getting a very rarefied view of a voltage clamp, because I just want to make progress here on the science. What this guy is doing is I set this to one voltage, which in the literature people call the command voltage or the clamp voltage. So that's going to be one axis on my graph. Okay. What this is doing is, in order to keep as the gain goes to infinity, in order to keep the output from exploding, these two voltages have to be the same. Okay. So this amplifier will pass any current necessary, right, to keep these voltages the same. So I'm probing the voltage in my cell. Okay. I'm using a servo mechanism to hold that voltage at a desired value. And I'm passing whatever current is necessary to hold it at that desired value. So this squeezes me. Now I can measure this current coming out of my op amp. Okay, the command voltage I know. So this allows me to make graphs of current as a function of voltage. Okay, and this is great. Okay, because really what's telling me is that this is a way to measure. Okay. I know this guy. This is just a reversal potential. This depends on ion concentrations. Okay. I know this guy. This is my command voltage. Okay. And everything I get out then is just proportional to this conductance. Okay. So this is a technique to measure the conductance, okay, for individual currents and to get out the voltage dependence and the time dependence. Okay. So let's just look. Everybody catch this? Okay. So let's just look at one of these guys versus time. Okay, so this is out of Hilla's book. There's a book by Hilla on channels. It's actually a spectacular book. It's quite good to read. Let's just see what's happening in the top trace. As you could see, it's current, okay, and it's current versus time, and you can see a couple of things. That first of all, each of these traces corresponds to a different command voltage. So what they're plotting is time here, and they start at some voltage, and right here is where they put a little step in a voltage. They change the voltage. And then you see a very fast current, right? You see something come in very quickly, and then it decays over time, and then this thing eventually reaches a new steady state value. Okay. Now this is an intact cell. So this contribution in principle is due to the combination of sodium and potassium. So let's see if we could separate them out. So separated out in two ways. So by adding tetrodotoxin, you're blocking the sodium current. Okay. So this is just a statement. As I increase the voltage, okay, every time I increase the voltage, I get this is one voltage, a larger 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 voltage. The curves are getting a little bit close together. Okay, the current is starting to saturate, which means the conductance is starting to saturate. Okay, and the other thing we can see very nicely here is we can see that as the voltage is getting bigger, the rise time is faster. Okay, so we're getting further away from equilibrium, so that the time constant is getting shorter, which is Mr. Hump. Okay, so I can make a family of these curves, and from a family of these curves, right, I could get out the saturation value, right? So that allows me to get out to pull out the probability of being open as a function of voltage, the steady state value, I should say, and then I could also extract out a time constant. Okay, and I could do these for both channels. Now the sodium channel is actually a little richer. It was kind of surprisingly richer. Okay, because now putting tetraethyl ammonium in blocks the potassium channel. Okay, this was actually one of the few. I think this is the only example of a rational search for something that worked. This was the data of Clay Armstrong, and he lined up all these bottles, and each one had a slightly different, had a slightly larger ion than the other. He was trying to figure out how big the pore was, and what he got out of this was a blocker for tetraethyl ammonium. It was like everything went through, block. Okay. So what happens here, as you can see, is that there's a very rapid rise. The current is going in the other direction, right? Because sodium goes from outside to inside, potassium goes from inside to outside. Okay, it rises very quickly. Okay, and as we mentioned, the rise here of the sodium current is what's responsible for the rising phase of the action potential. So that's very fast. And then we look at the decrement phase. The decrement phase is much slower. Okay, it's about an order of magnitude slower. This is what I mentioned yesterday, that the fall of the action potential is down by about a factor of 10 compared to the rise time. As a matter of fact, the decrement time here is sort of on the order of the rise time of the potassium current. Okay, so this actually, fitting this is a little more complicated, but only because in this case, in the case of the here, of the potassium current, this guy has a single activation parameter, N. Okay, in the case of sodium, it turns out that we could identify the initial rising phase with an activation and the decrementing phase with an inactivation. Okay, nonetheless, one could take this kind of data, okay, done by using a servo mechanism to force the voltage and pass a current to keep that voltage, okay, to extract out the voltage and time dependencies of all these conductances. That's the basic experiment, and it's the experiment that people use even today, okay? And this is another figure from Hilly. This is adapted from the original Hodgkin-Huxley paper. I think it's very nice. You can see that in A is the sum of the potassium and sodium currents, and in B, rather than putting TTX, they just took all the sodium out of the water. Okay, and again, you lose this fast inward current, and then you subtract the two traces, and you get the trace on the bottom, which is C, which is just the part in principle due to sodium. So many different ways of getting at the same data, and that's actually nice because you have many, many controls. You know, you can try a block, but blocks often aren't very good. Okay, I mean, it's like Nancy Reagan said, drugs can be dangerous. So sometimes you think you're blocking one thing and you're blocking something else. But if you can see the same result from pharmacological agents, as you could see from ion substitution experiments, you get a kind of confidence in the experimental data. Okay, now, once we've done this whole business, we can put together, again, this is a very, very classic picture of what the ionic basis is inside the cell. Okay? Because in the laboratory, you measure the voltage, okay? But once you've dissected, I mean, if you just do a current clamp experiment, but once you've pulled out in all the individual currents from your model, you could actually see what's happening. It's sort of a pretty picture. So this is the rising phase of the action potential. It just turns out, okay, the sodium current has a very, very fast on time. It's about 100 microseconds, okay? And that's responsible for the rising phase of the action potential. And this is, experimentally, this rising phase is almost a constant. You look at every kind of cortical cell you can, and basically the rising phase is about the same, okay? The decrementing phase, which is governed by this inactivation of sodium and this activation of potassium, slower activation of potassium, gives you the falling phase. Now, there's a total zoo of potassium channels, right? It's a very, very rich sort of genetic of genetic structure, and sort of the falling phase will vary dramatically between cells, right? Very much dependent on what the phenotype of the potassium channel. Okay, and it's the sum of these two currents basically that give the voltage its form, okay, in the cell. Okay, now the last thing is just to complete this self-consistency argument. I love this story because it was done without a computer. Okay. So let's go back here, which I surreptitiously wrote on the board before the lecture. Okay, we have the cable equation. This is a little bit of current we're injecting into the cell. So we have a displacement current, C dV dt, we throw away any space dependence in this experiment because a wire was placed down the axon, okay? And then what we have are these additional terms that represent voltage-dependent conductances. For each of these, we found a functional form that depends on an activation parameter, okay, and a voltage-dependent time constant, okay. So then you take sort of smooth curves through the data, right? So now you're in the world of models, right? Because you've taken smooth curves through the data, and you put them in, right? This is a massively ugly equation, and Larry is really going to describe a number of approximations, brutal and otherwise, okay, which will let you make analytical progress towards this. But you've measured the individual currents, and now you say, that's great, because now I go back, and instead of doing this servo experiment, this voltage clamp experiment, I'll do a standard current clamp experiment. I inject a little current into the cell, and I see what the voltage does. And I better make sure that I recover this initial voltage waveform based on these currents. Okay, so this is what closes the argument. This is shown here this is actually this is a somewhat more precise recalculation by Kenneth Cole of the Hodgkin-Huxley data. So the solid line is the actual measurement. Okay. The dotted lines, okay, or the circles were actually the calculation computed by Huxley by hand, because his computer was broken. Sounds like my laptop, okay? And he just was antsing, right? And the line through the dots is actually a curve calculated on a digital computer, right? So I think it's not perfect. The waveform doesn't match perfect, but I think this is absolutely spectacularly beautiful. Okay, and it turns out it's a sort of sensitive calculation, and here we go. It turns out again, this is from Cole. And you know, just changing some of the parameters in numerical calculation by a little bit is enough to cause this calculation to go way, way off the fritz. I mean, there's some sort of underlying deep mathematical issue. I mean, the pulse itself physically is an extremely stable phenomena, okay? But somehow numerically, this is a rather unstable procedure, which you kind of get when you ask people if they try to simulate the Hodgkin-Huxley equation. So there's some underlying math that might be fun for somebody to explore. Okay, so we have one more thing to do. Yeah.
What is the reason for this numerical instability?
I have no idea. Maybe somebody knows here. I know it exists, and maybe there's some interesting problem. I really don't know. People told me about this. I didn't believe it, and then I tried to simulate the equations myself, and I believed them. Okay. Okay, so the last thing is actually kind of important. The very last step is now to put space back in. Okay, and to assume a solution of the form that x minus ct is a constant, right? It's just wave propagation, right? So write this in terms of a single variable. Now, what you need to do then, this introduces another parameter, which is the speed. Okay, and again, this was simulated numerically and compared with the measured speeds. And the measured speeds and the numerical speeds were within about 15% of each other, which I think was very, very, very good. And it probably the reason that it was different goes back to a set of measurements that Rowan completed about 5 years ago by a fellow named Fromholtz in Germany, because they didn't really have very precise. It turned out that the measurements of the internal resistance of the cytoplasm were probably sort of badly off in these initial experiments. And Fromholtz remeasured this by actually looking at the entire propagation profile using a stretched out axon and voltage sensitive dyes. Okay, so a lot of additional technology was pushed into this. So I think given the numbers and the time, again, it was quite extraordinary. So the second part of the last part of this self-consistency argument is not only do you get the right shape, but in fact you get a propagating pulse. You find that there's a single variable that describes space and time, and you get about the right speed. Okay, so this kind of closes the argument, and it's pretty work, and it's actually sometimes it's worth reading the original papers on something, and I think I've never seen a textbook actually. I've only seen textbooks destroy Hodgkin-Huxley papers. Never. So I think it's actually worth reading back a little bit, because these guys are actually very, very smart, and they sort of knew all this on background chemistry and physics, and shook all this out. And the thing that's sort of remarkable about this is that the same prescription applies today. Just open up any neuroscience article, and just the same experimental paradigm. You know, except for the fact that the price of amplifiers has gone up tremendously, is basically the same. Okay, so we'll take a break, and then Larry will pick up.